replicate what existed in New York. So I started looking for a storefront at the ground level. And walking up and down the streets of Haight-Ashbury, there was a place on Frederick Street that was vacant. It's right next to a big football stadium called Kezar Stadium, pretty big stadium. That's where all the big football games, professional and college football games, were played. There was a team called the San Francisco 49ers, who were very famous. So this place was had a big for rent sign in it, and the agent for that place was on a nearby street, Geary Street. Not so near, but I went out to see him, and he had an interesting name. His name was Ruby Goodman. So it was kind of an interesting name. Ruby being considered the best of gems and good man. So he said it was for rent, and rather than tell him we were going to go in there and chant, because I didn't have a shaved head then, it looked pretty ordinary. It didn't look like a hippie. Had a little beard, but he was kind of liberal-minded, and I told him that we were going to be having yoga classes in there, and that would be what we would do. He didn't seem to mind at all. Wanted to rent the place. And so he came over, we had a look at it, and it was $125 a month. We thought that was okay. Have yoga classes, harmless people, pay their rent, all that. So we rented the storefront, and it was at a time of great social fermentation, I guess you'd call it. There was a very strong feeling in the air that the voting age would be lowered to 18, that the war in Vietnam would end, that LSD was going to last forever and as a legalized drug, and that the young people were going to sort of take over the planet, so to speak. That was this feeling that was there among a lot of the people. While I was walking down Haight Street one day, a voice behind me said, "Are you with Bhaktivedanta?" And it was this kind of long-haired fellow, and he knew about the Krishna consciousness movement, and he said, "Are you going to set up a temple here?" And I said, "Well, we hope to." And he said, "Well, have you found anything?" I said, "No." And he said, "Well, I can help you. I'll get you a temple," just like that. It was pretty amazing. So we ended up visiting this fellow's apartment. He was one of the leaders of this Haight-Ashbury community. He was a painter. So we ended up going up to his apartment. We were all sitting around smoking a big water pipe. And we refused, and they thought that was a little untactful, but anyway, we chanted with them, and they were all loosened up because they were all kind of high in marijuana, whatever it was. And we had a nice chant. But anyway, he wanted to. His name was Michael Bowen. He didn't really help us, but he wanted to, and we managed to get the storefront. Then there was a couple who volunteered to offer their help in making a sign for the front of the temple. So we decided we wanted to call it Radha Krishna Temple and have it in English letters, our sign, but that would look Sanskrit. Here's a font you can get now on the internet called Sumarkan, which consists of regular Roman letters, but they have lines coming out at the top at an angle and a line across the top, so it looks like Sanskrit, actually. So we made a design that this is what the sign should look like. So this couple, they were kind of artistic. They cut out letters that were about maybe 30, 40 centimeters high, Radha Krishna Temple, and they looked like that. They had these kind of Sanskrit lines going over them. And they painted it red. They put some kind of shellac or varnish on it was plywood. It was this kind of wood that's pressed out of other wood, fiberboard or whatever. And then they put a coat of red over it, and then a coat of gold on top of that. The idea was that if you just painted gold on wood without varnish or without red underneath it, it would deteriorate and it would start looking like wood, and it wouldn't have the real luster that gold paint is supposed to have. So they did that. They just kind of volunteered to do it. And that was what the storefront looked like. Right across, there was a little ridge that stuck out from the window. It was a big sort of picture window, very large window, about maybe 3 or 4 meters square. And above it was this ridge, and it stuck up, and it said the Radha Krishna Temple. And they painted a red background on it, so it really stood out. And it was the storefront, but it had a nice look. And then we purchased maroon, sort of burgundy-colored carpet that went from wall to wall. And it had a look of a temple. At that time, we didn't really have any deities, so we made an altar at the front that Prabhupada would sit on. It was a kind of rectangular shaped room, something like this, and Prabhupada sat at one end, the far end, from the door, and that was the way it was set up for him. As far as this mantra rock dance, it really wasn't my idea. It was really Shyamasundar's idea, because he had gone to school with one of the managers of the Grateful Dead, so he thought it would be a good idea to raise money. And this gathering took place shortly after Prabhupada arrived. I mean, I'll read on it. He comments some more. Although in his letter, Mukunda had enclosed a plane ticket, some of Swamiji's followers refused to accept that Swamiji would use it. What actually happened there was Shyamasundar and I decided to phone Prabhupada because we had rented the storefront. We'd arranged for this dance, and we thought we would just phone Prabhupada and invite him to come. We'd never been on an airplane before. It took a boat to come from India to the United States. He called it the airship. So I remember we were in a phone booth in San Francisco, and we phoned Prabhupada and said, well, we have the premises now, and we have a fundraising event that's planned, and we'd like you to come out, and we're going to get you a plane ticket. So he said, oh, so then you'll this is the first time, second time, maybe you've talked to Prabhupada on the phone. He said, oh, so then you'll send me the plane ticket. And, well, then we said, no, we would buy the ticket, and then he would just have to go and present himself, and they would issue him the ticket. It would all be done through a telex machine. And that was also very new to him. He didn't quite grasp how that was going to work, so he tried to explain it, and then he was satisfied. He said he would do that. Before that happened, we had arranged for the Grateful Dead to play, and another group called the Moby Grape. Actually, they had their debut at this concert. They were a struggling rock group. They hadn't had any big venues. And it so happened that Malati, Shyamasundar's wife then, was walking down a street one day near where we were staying, Lucky Alley, in the Mission District of the Haight-Ashbury, of the San Francisco, not far from Haight-Ashbury, and she heard this group playing. And just being the way we were, she just kind of walked in, because apartment where they were playing was at the ground level, and she listened to this song. And they were 18, 19 year olds, and blonde, long hair. And she said, you guys sound pretty good. Do you want a gig? And he said, sure. And she said, we'll pay you $250. That was the minimum all the bands were demanding, because that was the union scale minimum for anything. And they were really right into it. And we sort of had to trust her that she knew that they were okay, that they were going to be all right, and they got billed along with the Grateful Dead. It was the first time they'd ever played in a major venue like that. Then there was another group called the Big Brother and the Holding Company, starring Janis Joplin. Those were the three bands that were going to play. So we actually designed it so that Prabhupada was going to be there, because we thought it would be appropriate for him to lead a chant, even though they were the rock groups. And while we were in this Michael Bowen's apartment, sitting around chanting with him, and they were smoking out of a big water pipe, we thought that it would be really good to have Allen Ginsberg come out to this dance. It was in one of the major ballrooms, the Avalon Ballroom on Sutter Street near Van Ness. It was one of two big ballrooms. There was the Fillmore Ballroom, so this was like their competitor. And the guy who ran it was named Chet Helms. He had long hair, and he was about 28 or 29. We used to kind of joke about him. We called him the 30-year-old hippie, that someone at that age could still look like a hippie with long hair, and he wore a suit and tie and glasses. And he was kind of a bit of a folk hero, because he ran dances at the Avalon Ballroom with light shows two nights a every Saturday, Friday and Saturday night. So we had to negotiate with him and the hall and security, and it ended up but paying the bands and everything costing maybe $1,500, close to $2,000. So that was all set up, and we were sitting around this guy's apartment, and we were thinking that we needed a celebrity to come, and we were thinking to ask Allen Ginsberg, but none of us really knew him. He said, oh, I know Allen. He said, I think I'll call him. I think he'll come, because he was on the East Coast. At that time, that was a long ways away, 3,000 miles or so. Whatever that is, 5,000 kilometers. And he somehow or other phoned him and he agreed to come out because it was the desire of all these newly emerging hippie types to have Allen Ginsberg, who was their folk hero, come out to the West Coast, make the trip. And so somehow or other he persuaded him to come. And then when Allen Ginsberg came out, of course he met Prabhupada and had some conversations. And Prabhupada asked him what the hippies were. Where does this term come from? And Allen told him that, well, the Chinese people used to smoke opium a lot and they laid on their side, on their hips, and that's how the word hippie came about. I'd never heard that before, but that's what he told Prabhupada anyway. So the billing was that it would be Prabhupada, Allen Ginsberg, Big Brother, Moby Grape, and the Grateful Dead. That was the group. And then there was Ben Van Meter and Roger Hilliard. They were the lighting people. So a person named Harvey Cohn, who was, later became Haridas, used to work in Madison Avenue. We mandated him to make the poster. So he made this poster. It looked like very much like the psychedelic posters of the age. It had that kind of wavy, hard-to-read look, like underwater almost. And it had a beautiful, you've seen it, and it's in the line, it's a picture of Prabhupada with this kind of moiré pattern emanating out of his face in different colors. It was blue and kind of a bluish magenta colored poster. So that was the poster, and then we gave a date, and the price was $2.50 for people to come to the dance. And it was, we couldn't have it on a Friday or Saturday because those were all booked weeks in advance, so we had to have it on a Sunday night, and we didn't really know if it was going to attract a lot of people or not. We were handing out leaflets of the poster, sort of, you know, this book size, and put the poster up all over the place, had ads in the newspapers, and anyway, it turned out that a lot of people did come. It was very crowded, in fact. We'd taken pictures of the Brijbasi posters of the different pastimes of Krishna, and we made slides of those. We gave those slides to the two people who did the light show, and they were very happy to have them, and they made a light show out of it. So in addition to the bands, these people were going to have a Hare Krishna light show in the ballroom, which they did. Those who knew they could not leave New York began to criticize the idea. Swamiji's going to San Francisco. They didn't think that people out on the West Coast could take care of Swamiji properly. Swamiji appearing with rock musicians? Those people out there didn't seem to have the proper respect. Anyway, there was no suitable temple there. There was no printing press, no Back to Godhead magazine. Why should Swamiji leave New York to attend a function like that with strangers in California? How could he leave them behind in New York? How could their spiritual life continue without him? Timidly, one or two dissenters indirectly expressed some of these feelings to Prabhupada, as if almost wishing to admonish him for thinking of leaving them, and even hinting that things would not go well, either in San Francisco or New York, if he departed. But they found Prabhupada quite confident and determined. He did not belong to New York, he belonged to Krishna, and he had to go wherever Krishna desired him to preach. Prabhupada showed a spirit of complete detachment, eager to travel and expand the chanting of Hare Krishna, Brahmananda. But we were shocked that he was going to leave. I never thought that Krishna consciousness would go beyond the Lower East Side or to speak of New York City. I thought this was it, and it would stay here eternally. In the last days of the second week of January, final plane reservations were made, and the devotees began packing Swamiji's manuscripts away in trunks. Ron Shore, a new devotee recruited from Tompkins Square Park, had collected enough money for a plane ticket, and the devotees decided that he should accompany Prabhupada as his personal assistant. Prabhupada explained that he would only be gone a few weeks and that he wanted all the programs to go on in his absence. He waited in his room while the boys arranged for a car to take him to the airport. The day was gray and cold, and steam hissed in the radiators. He would take only a suitcase, mostly clothes and some books. He checked the closet to see that his manuscripts were in order. Kirtananda would take care of his things in the apartment. He sat down at his desk, where for more than 6 months, he sat so many times, working for hours at the typewriter, preparing his Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, and where he had sat talking to so many guests and to his followers. But today, he would not be talking with friends or typing a manuscript, but waiting the last few minutes alone before his departure. This was his second winter in New York. He had launched a movement of Krishna consciousness. A few sincere boys and girls joined. They were already all known on the Lower East Side. Many notices in the newspapers. and it was only the beginning. He had left Vrindavan for this. At first he had not been certain whether he would stay in America more than 2 months. In Butler, he had presented his books, but then in New York he had seen how Dr. Mishra had developed things, and the Mayavadis had a big building. And they were taking money and not even delivering the real message of the Gita, but the American people were looking. It had been a difficult year. His godbrothers hadn't been interested in helping, although this is what their Guru Maharaj, Srila Bhakti Saraswati Thakur, wanted, and what Sri Chaitanya wanted. Because Lord Chaitanya wanted it, his blessings would come, and it would happen. This was a nice place, 26 Second Avenue. He had started here. The boys would keep it up. Some of them were donating their salaries. It was a good start. Prabhupada looked at his watch. He put on his tweed winter coat and his hat and shoes and his right hand in his bead bag and continued chanting. He walked out of the apartment, down the stairs, and through the courtyard, which was now frozen and still, its trees starkly bare, without a single leaf remaining. And he left the storefront behind. He left. Even while Brahmananda Rupanuga and Satsrupa were at their office jobs, there was not even a farewell scene or a farewell address. Anyways, that was his first airplane trip. And there was always a bit of tension between the devotees in New York and the devotees in San Francisco. The San Francisco ones were considered to be overly liberal and involved in this hippie movement. And the ones in New York were seen to be as more conservative and more strict and not involved. Of course, that movement began to drift out to the East Coast, and there was a Fillmore Ballroom East established right across from the temple, so that sort of movement took over, you might say, in the Lower East Side. When the first Mridanga came, it first came to New York, and the New York devotees sort of reluctantly had to send it on to San Francisco where Prabhupada was. And we were very happy to see it, and Prabhupada was also very happy to see it. Actually, he ripped part of his dhoti off about a meter square and wrapped it around the first Mridanga when it came, and everyone was very startled. We saw him rip his dhoti right in front of us and wrap it around the Mridanga. He said, "This must never come off." And then he showed the devotees how to put some water around the outer edge of the application on the large end of the Mridanga so that it would somehow or other stay on and have a nice resonant ring to it. And then when he started playing the Mridanga, it was wonderful to see how he kind of embraced it. It was almost like one of his own children. And he played it so wonderfully that everybody danced in ecstasy. It was a very nice, wonderful experience to see Prabhupada and to hear him play the Mridanga. So reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, third canto, 8th chapter, 20, oh, probably, yeah, 21st. I think there's a second canto over there. Maybe you can bring it to me. Bhagavatam. O Vidura, while searching in that way about his existence, Brahmat reached his ultimate time, which is the eternal wheel in the hand of Vishnu, and which generates fear in the mind of the living entity like the fear of death. I'll read the next one because there's no purport here. Tato nivritto prati labdhakama svadishyam asara puna sadevaha shanaya jita shvasa nivritta chito nyasidat arudha samadhi yoga. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. Thereafter, being unable to achieve the desired destination, he retired from such searching and came back again to the top of the lotus. Thus controlling all objectives, he concentrated his mind on the Supreme Lord. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Samadhi involves concentrating the mind upon the supreme cause of all. Even if one is unaware of whether his actual nature is personal, impersonal, or localized, concentration of the mind on the Supreme is certainly a form of devotional service. To cease from personal sense endeavors and to concentrate on the Supreme Cause is a sign of self-surrender. And when self-surrender is present, that is a sure sign of devotional service. Each and every living entity needs to engage in devotional service to the Lord if he wishes to understand the ultimate cause of his existence. Thereafter, being unable to achieve the desired destination, he retired from such searching and came back again to the top of the lotus. Thus, Controlling all objectives, he concentrated his mind on the Supreme Lord. Because Lord Brahma is considered to be the most intelligent of all, his searching is not to be condemned. It indicates that searching is the province of very intelligent people. Sometimes people who are characterized as searching are thought to be people who are dissatisfied or unknowing or airheaded, as they say, or without a root, without proper anchors, and not really whole and not sane. Sometimes devotees are even characterized or in their past existences as being searchers looking for the truth. Inquisitive and open-minded people are sometimes like this. In fact, in one sense, they're almost always like this, because we hear about research. What is research? Research is a way of searching for the truth. And it's a symbol, it's an indication of being open-minded. I was having a chat with Prana a couple days ago about schools and teaching and administration and development of young people's minds and so on, and it was quite interesting because he told me that he had met an administrator in one of the schools. Apparently, like this administrator, some administrators in schools aren't really that interested in education. They might have a hidden agenda, they might want to make money, they might want a reputation, they might want their school to be the best, have a good reputation, but they may not be really interested in forging out new territory, in exploring the boundaries of education, expanding its ability to bring people out into the world. And an interesting thing that came out is that it's difficult to know what kind of education, what types of things that children need to be prepared for, because we don't know what kind of world we're going to be living in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, the period of time that's going to elapse while these young people mature into adulthood. It's very difficult to know. We live in a very changing world. It's very, not only changing, but it's kind of whimsical, because we don't know what it's going to be, you know, on people's minds, or what kind of a lifestyle, or what sort of things are going to be in the air. They're all sort of in the air. We don't necessarily embrace them, but they're there. They're just different trends that society is there. Some are sociological, some are technical. They're all different ways. So how does one prepare? And he was talking about how the what's it called? The New Zealand Administration of Education? The Ministry of Education, is that what it's called? Yeah, how they, you know, kind of look at the Hare Krishna school and compare it to other schools, and kind of interesting. And one of the things that came out was that they were saying that even they don't know exactly what to prepare children for, so it's always a big question mark as to not only how to teach, but what to teach, what subjects to teach, because if right things aren't taught, young people might go and say, well, we weren't prepared, we didn't learn all these things in school, and they become resentful. I was a little resentful myself, because one of the counselors I had when I was in the younger years said, well, you should go into this, and actually it wasn't the kind of thing that I was really very interested in or very good at, it turned out. So I sort of harbored some resentment for that. So you know, you can grow up and resent the way you're taught about things, the way you were brought up. You can look back on it and say, well, it wasn't right or it wasn't proper. The searching educators and people who are open-minded, if they're good teachers, they think that their learning is actually never completed. They're learning from their students just like their students are learning from them. They're learning from the questions that they're being asked. They're having to delve deeper into their subjects. They're having to become more expert at it. And as it's mentioned here, concentration of the mind on the Supreme is certainly a form of devotional service. Sometimes it's thought that by concentrating the mind on a particular one single thing, that one becomes very narrow-minded. The notion is that if we just learn one particular thing, or we concentrate on an individual aspect of life, that we're going to grow up being very myopic and unable to development, they'll say they don't understand the scope of the universe. How many universes there are? Some say that they start and they stop, they start and they stop. Some say that they start at a certain point, then it's all going to end at a certain point. Some say there's black holes. So people who are very intelligent are also sometimes very intelligent. They're searching. They feel that they don't have answers to everything. But many of them don't have an idea, that they don't have a sense that there is a design that does know everything, that there is something or some entity somewhere where all this information is stored. It's all later on unraveled and unfolded and played out, but it's actually stored. So we have verses in the Bhagavad Gita that tell us that we should concentrate on Krishna. Vyavasaya mika buddhira ekeha kuru nandana bahushaka yanatasya buddhaya vyavasayana. In that second chapter, there's a verse that says that one has to come, vyavasaya mika buddhira ekeha, one has to be single-pointed in one's thinking. And if one isn't, then the intelligence of such person will be many branched. There's another verse that has that same phrase in it, vyavasaya mika buddhira vogaishvarya prasaktana taya prakrita shita sam vyavasaya mika buddhira samado navidiyate. And that verse tells us that if we aren't single-minded in our concentration upon Krishna, our minds will be attracted to sense gratification, will be bewildered by sense enjoyment. And in the mind of such person, resolute determination to devotional service cannot take place. This single-mindedness and resolute determination to engage in devotional service is quite important for devotees. As it's indicated in that verse in the Bhagavad Gita, if the mind isn't focused on Krishna, then the mind will be many, many branched, and it will be out of control. There's another verse that says that the mind will be the best friend of the worst enemy, according to how well we control it. And one can see that the mind is like that. It's also described as chinchala, very flickering, very unstable, like the goddess of fortune. Sometimes people are blessed with good fortune, good money, good everything, and sometimes everything's bad fortune. They have accidents, they have diseases, they have deaths, they have sicknesses, and so on. So the mind is like that. It's very capricious. It moves very much from one thing to the other. The way the human mind works, it's very strange. You can be doing one thing, thinking about something else completely different, and so many accidents happen like that. So many people are killed in automobiles because they're not concentrating, because their minds are flickering, they're capricious, they're thinking about what they want to do when they get home or what they did at work. And hundreds of people die every day in automobile accidents, and it's largely because they're not realizing that they're wielding a lethal weapon every time you get behind the wheel. It's a lethal weapon, it's very dangerous actually. You know, you just veer over a little bit and it's all over, you know, oncoming car. So the mind is like that, and therefore Krishna advises us to concentrate and be single-minded and focus ourselves. So this was the way that Lord Brahma created the universe. He actually concentrated. He didn't think of all the different ways of the different constituents of the universe and think of the different charts and different molecules and how cells are constituted, but he actually concentrated on the sound vibration Krishna gave him, ta and pa. I want to read that. This is a very nice verse here in the second canto about how from the heart, knowledge was transmitted to Lord Brahma through two syllables, ta and pa, which means tenses. The verse is sachintayan cha sachintayan raksharan ekatambasi apashrino dirgatim vacho vibhu par sheshu yat sodasham ekavimsham iskinchananam nripayat dhanambidhi. While thus engaged in thinking in the water, Ramaji heard twice from nearby two syllables joined together. One of the syllables was taken from the 16th and the other from the 21st of the Sparsha alphabets, and both joined to become the wealth of the renounced order of life. It says that poverty is the wealth of the Brahman, so the wealth of the renounced order of life is tapasya, or voluntary austerity. Purport. The Sanskrit language. In the Sanskrit language, the consonant alphabets are divided into two divisions, namely Sparsha Varnas and the Talavya Varnas. From Ka to Ma, the letters are known as the Sparsha Varnas, and the 16th of the group is called Ta, whereas the 21st letter is called Pa. So when they are joined together, the word Tapa, or penance, is constructed. Thus, penance is the beauty and wealth of the Brahmins and the renounced order of life. According to Bhagavad philosophy, every human being is meant simply for this Tapa and no other business. Because by penance only one can realize his self. And self-realization, not sense gratification, is the business of human life. This is one of the things that separates devotees from non-devotees. Sanisha sarva-bhutanam yasyam sarvati jamimi. You know this verse, that one is like night for the devotees, is like daytime for those immersed in sense gratification. Sanisha sarva-bhutanam tasyam jagrati samyami yasyam jagrati bhutani sanisha pashyato mrihe. So there's a radical difference. When I was in high school, there was a drama that our seniors had to construct, and I just remember this one scene. There was someone going to work, and this man was passing someone who was coming from a party late that night, carrying her shoes. And drunk, and you know, it was like that. It was like what was night for one was daytime for the other. So for the devotees, it's kind of like that. Up at 4 o'clock in the morning, people around think it's a nuisance that we're chanting, and yet if they're playing their stereos at midnight, we think that's a nuisance. So there's that duality. And someone who actually concentrates on tapa, who believes in renouncing sense gratification, is often thought to be unstable or crazy. And those who are concentrating their minds and engaging in tapasya and concentrating their minds on Krishna tend to think that it's craziness to be playing a stereo at 1 a.m, to be drinking and dancing and carrying on. So this is, therefore it's said that tapa or tapasya or penance is the wealth of the Brahmins. It's actually a kind of wealth. It is a wealth. Not the kind of wealth that means you have a better boat, a better car, an airplane, better vacations and so on. According to the Bhagavad philosophy, every human being is meant simply for this tapa and no other business, because by penance only one can realize his self. And self-realization, not sense gratification, is the business of human life. Tapo divyam putraka yena sattva. Rishabhi told us that this is actually why you're here. Tapo divyam putraka yena sattva. There's no other engagement for a human being, because if you love Krishna, you automatically renounce certain other things. And if you renounce other things but don't love Krishna, you're also in a bit of never-never land. The place doesn't really mean anything. But if you renounce the material world and you develop love for Krishna, then that's perfection. So the wealth of the Brahmins is this tapasya. And as we develop love for Krishna, we automatically lose our taste for sense gratification. So tapasya, in that sense, is automatically developed. But in another sense, because we have to resist the temptations of Maya, it's necessary to practice different forms of tapasya, and that's what the regulated principles are about. That's what chant 16 rounds is all about, in case you didn't happen to notice. This tapa, or penance, was begun from the very beginning of the creation, and it was first adopted by the Supreme Spiritual Master, Lord Brahma. By tapasya only, one can get the profit of human life, and not by a polished civilization of animal life. The animal does not know anything except sense gratification in the jurisdiction of eat, drink, be merry, and enjoy. But the human being is made to undergo tapasya for going back to Godhead, back home. Does that make sense? Have any questions or comments? Okay, I'm gonna. All right. Go right.
You're
asking me what my realizations are about keeping that focus so that one doesn't get caught up in sense gratification?
Keep developing the mind again.
How to control the mind.
Yeah, and keeping it single.
And how do we keep the mind single pointed so that it's not spread out and looking for different things? Very interesting point. This is alluded to a bit in the Bhagavad Gita in the 6th chapter on Dhyana Yoga. It talks about mind control. In the last verse of that chapter, Yoginam api sarvesham makata nantaratmanam. There's some talk about, in Prabhupada's purport, about controlling the mind. And in a lecture on that verse, he's talked about how one way to control the mind is to always be thinking how to spread Krishna consciousness. In fact, he went so far as to say that's the secret of controlling the mind. You should be texting your brain, he said, how to somehow influence people to take Krishna consciousness. And this is a form of mind control. You should be meditating on it. Of course, there are many other ways to control the mind. One of the ways one of the best ways is to stay in good association, because if we follow the Upadeshamrita's instruction to associate with devotees, and to the Pratilakshana verse tells us that we should reveal our minds to devotees, guhyamatrapi prichati, that really helps, because the things that are most interesting to talk about are not, you know, who won the football game or what are we going to do for Christmas, but what's Krishna doing? And how, what kind of devotional service are you going to engage in? Am I going to engage in it? But that's actually Dhyana Yoga. That's the perfection of devotional service. So association with devotees, Ramananda Roy also glorified this, is one of the ways that we can keep the mind very focused, by keeping good association. It's associating with people that makes us happy, or makes us lively, or makes us think. Somehow in the back of our minds, we're always thinking about the people that we know, the people that we love, the people that we want to please, the people that we look up to, the people that we're training, the people that depend on us, the people that we love. So association is very, very important. And I think Prabhupada's on record is saying, if you associate with drunkards, you become a drunkard. If you associate with devotees, you become a devotee. You had that experience. If one reveals one's mind, or is in the habit of revealing one's mind and getting involved in intimate exchanges that are based on sense gratification, on those kinds of questions and answers, and are really based on the kinds of things that lead to more sense gratification, then the mind's going to be difficult, very, very difficult to control. Of course, as Arjuna said, it's very difficult to control anyway, in any case. But by associating with devotees, by worshipping the deity, by molding one's life in such a way that one is always thinking of Krishna, burning incense, having pictures on the wall of Krishna, That's also another form of association, eating Krishna prasadam, doing things to spread Krishna consciousness, and keeping good association, keeping pure, developing purity in the heart, associating with people that we look up to. That's all part of controlling the mind, and helps us a lot. And just always to try to think about Krishna, to try to chant Hare Krishna all the time. Sometimes when we're walking along, or just we're just thinking, we're doing something, we're not chanting our rounds, and then sometimes I think, well, what was I doing for the last half hour? I was thinking about what I did, or what I was going to do, or something like that. I mean, if you're thinking about spreading Krishna consciousness, that's good, but was I chanting? And very often I wasn't. So if you're always chanting all the time, that, you know, you're not having to do something that requires a lot of concentration, crunching numbers or whatever it might be, even then it's possible. You should be chanting Hare Krishna. And that keeps the mind very focused on Krishna. The more we, in our spare time, if there is such a thing, chant Hare Krishna in the shower, going to sleep, waking up. There's always some time. Anyway, those are some ideas about how the mind can be better focused. Some of my perspectives on it. Maybe somebody else would like to add to that, and some hints about how we can better concentrate the mind on Krishna. Yes? Spend any time?
Devotee association with the practice is most, the main, is most powerful during the morning prayer. And I'm pretty convinced that if somebody doesn't have a habit in his regard, he will have a difficult time to control his mind.
Yeah, because then you're in the temple, you're with the deities, you're shoulder with the devotees, you're in an atmosphere that you don't want to think any thoughts of sense gratification. And this is a symptom of advancement that they're always very attached to. Association with the deities, with each other, chanting, hearing. And I think that was something Prabhupada wanted too, isn't it? Devotees that live in communities, that they should be very strict about their program and their chanting in the morning. Yeah.
Always planning devotional service.
Planning.
Yeah, always thinking, always planning a devotional service.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's an interesting point. So he was making a point about planning, how planning is very important. I read somewhere that there was a study done by, it was Princeton University. Their study showed that the students who had goals when they came into that university, after time, were worth more to the university than all the other students combined. How they judged that, I don't exactly know, but it had to do with the contributions, financial contributions they were making after they were alumni, and the kind of input, I think, also that they were giving from their intelligence. They were planning their lives. So for devotees, as you indicate, if we're, whenever we have that free time, if we're always thinking ahead, we're planning how to better our devotional service, how it's going to be better for us as we grow in time, how it's going to be better for everyone around us. That's definitely an important way to control the mind. In other words, we shouldn't be planning to have a better material situation. Yes, Ramsey Pilas.
There was one instance this came to Krishna Chaitanya, number 13, which says, to concentrate the mind, one should voluntarily accept the life of devotees, celibacy, and abstain from sense gratification. One should be truthful, clean, and something else, and should follow regularly the rules and regulations and regularly change the problems.
Yeah, that's very good. Different, these are, that you were naming different principles that help us develop in our Krishna consciousness, concentrate our minds. Chanting, following the regulated principles strictly. What else did you say?
Truthful.
Be truthful. Practice celibacy. Yeah, these are some of the different elements of austerity that we engage in, that people can't, who engage in sense gratification can't fathom. But if we're strict about these things, and there's many other qualities that are mentioned, Chaitanya Chaitanya, Vatitikshakuna, tolerance, mercifulness, friendliness, you know, there's this,
non-violence,
so many things that help us. This is a very good point. Actually, I think I mentioned this in class, that Prabhupada tacked up to the wall with 26 qualifications because he thought they were so important for us to know, to think about, you know, am I being more silent, am I being poetic, am I being expert? And in a class, I think it was a, I don't know, yeah, it was in a class rather than a conversation, he said that we should measure ourselves up against these qualifications that are mentioned in the books, in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, and that these would be the test of how we're becoming Krishna conscious. So these are our ways of controlling the mind. The mind should always be active. The mind tends to be lazy. We tend to just kind of kick back and let it float and float downstream, so to speak. And that's a kind of laziness, isn't it? That we don't really try to advance. We're just kind of not thinking. Of course, lazy intelligence has been glorified as being a way to a very refined kind of intelligence. But that's a pretty rarefied and exceptional sort of thing Prabhupada was talking about. But even lazy intelligent people, they're not lazy. Their intelligence isn't lazy. They're actually, he was using it in terms of like someone who invents something, for example, or solves a mathematical problem. You sort of forget about it for a while and you come back to it, or in your dream or in your sort of daydreaming state, you come to it all sort of falls into place, the musical composition or the invention or the solution to the mathematical problem. But that's not laziness. These are people that are trying to solve problems, trying to write things, or music, or they're really concentrating. They're just letting the mind kind of have its little play of, you know, back and forth. You know, draw the reins on it, let the reins little loose. But it's actually very active. So the more active we are in thinking about how to engage in these types of austerities, and austerity of the mind is talked about also in the 17th chapter. So that's also there. And these, some of these things, in order to make the mind austere, like celibacy and engaging in devotional service constantly, that helps purify the mind. Any others? Yes, Abhay?
I once said one time that my only qualification, as he was talking about, as being a spiritual master, is that I didn't deviate 1 inch from the instructions of my spiritual master.
Mm-hmm.
So I was always thinking about the spiritual master's instructions. Like that.
Yeah.
It helps focus
on that. Yeah. As Prabhupada said, that he was asked to print books, even if we have to dismantle the temples. That was his way of saying that it was very extremely important, and there was nothing more important for him and his mission to do than to print and distribute books. So whatever the instructions given to us by higher authorities, spiritual master, by Krishna, that's something to be taken, as Prabhupada said, as a life and soul, and that helps keep the mind very pure. So that, yeah, I think you were making the point that taking instructions from a spiritual master and meditating on them is a kind of samadhi, a way to keep the mind purified. Yeah, very good.
And also how Prabhupada has such a vision. Like when we're sitting on a park bench very early on about what they meant, there's a man with a microphone. And the person got the impression that Prabhupada had this amazing vision in all these temples around the world, although at that time there wasn't any temples.
Yeah, this mention of Prabhupada having the vision that there would be many temples and many devotees, centers of Krishna consciousness all over the world, is an indication how important it is to have goals in life. There's a saying about, you know, a man without a goal is like a ship without a rudder, something to that effect, that we actually have to plan and have goals and visions like Prabhupada did. They may not be as extreme and as far-reaching and ambitious as the ones they seem to be ambitious as Prabhupada had, but nevertheless, why not? Why not have goals, and why not be a little ambitious about Krishna consciousness? Prabhupada certainly was. Because if we look back at the last 20 or 30 years, I can't conceive how we got here from there. And if we try to look into a crystal ball and figure out what's going to be in 30 years from now, it's very hard to figure it out. You know? Very difficult. It's like these educators were saying. We don't know what kind of a world we're preparing these children for. We don't know, as devotees, what Krishna consciousness is going to evolve into in 30 years. We have no idea. I mean, we can speculate. We can think about different things. We can hope for different things. We can plan for certain things. But it's actually hard to tell what shape it's really going to have. We don't know. But at the same time, even not knowing doesn't mean we can't plan. In fact, it's even more reason to plan, because everybody's planning. Everyone who's successful is planning. Like Prabhupada, he had big plans. And even though they didn't exactly maybe manifest in every detail the way he envisioned them, the main thrust of what he wanted to happen was that Krishna consciousness would spread all over the world. It did happen. That's just some other... Yes, Gauroy.
It said that blind following is
complete.
Uh-huh. And I heard quite just the other day in that network book distribution talk about Shivana saying, I'm simply blind, you follow
very much. Yeah. So the question is, can you be a blind follower? Is it good to be a blind follower? Because Prabhupada said that he was following his spiritual master like a blind slave, or words that, like that. And at the same time, he talked about using the mind in a scientific way to understand and not be a blind follower. I think it was words to that effect. I think blind slave was used somewhere in the Bhagavad-gita. I remember reading that. So there's a story that Prabhupada was walking with some devotees, and he was pointing at different things, saying, that's a nice car, we can use it in Krishna service. And he was walking with a group of devotees, and they were affirming, oh yes, that is a nice car, we can use cars for Krishna service. And then they were walking in a nice park, and he said, we're chanting our rounds, we're thinking about Krishna, we're walking, so this is a good place to engage in. This park is very useful for Krishna service. Oh yes, Prabhupada, it's very good for Krishna service, certainly. And then he said, and these tulsi beads, these are genuine tulsi beads, and they help me chant. And I think that any kind of beads that you chant on are good for Krishna consciousness. Oh yes. The devotee said, yes, Prabhupada, we can use any kind of beads in Krishna service. This is very good for Krishna service. And then with this cane, Prabhupada pointed to a dog and said, and this dog also can be used in Krishna service. And the devotee said, yes, Prabhupada, that dog will be very useful in Krishna service. And I was, no, you fool, you can't use a dog in Krishna service. How can you use a dog? You're a blind follower. So there's a kind of saying, or a kind of thought, that thoughtlessness or kind of laziness is really what is meant by blind following. Not thinking, really, because the instructions that were imparted by Prabhupada basically were good instructions. So it's said in the fourth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, that we should question the spiritual master. Not challengingly, but we should try to ascertain, well, how does this happen? If Krishna consciousness is going to spread, how is it? If we're going to build a temple, well, how do we do it? You know, how do we put the bricks and mortar in there? And how's it actually going to take place? And how do we get the money in? These kind of questions were sometimes asked to Prabhupada. And he would say, he gave instructions about earning money and getting money. At one time, there was very little money in the London Bhaktivedanta Manor temple. Prabhupada said, well, how many Indian people are in this country? The answer was, oh, 400,000 or 500,000. And then he said, well, do you think that every one of those people could give one pound, even a month? And well, yeah, I guess so. So then he started thinking, well, 400,000 pounds, that's quite a bit of money, you know. And so then the devotees acted on that, and they gradually unfolded how to do it and figured it all out. So it's like Prabhupada said, well, Krishna's a rich man, there's never any shortage. You know, if you divide all the money, everyone's got $1 million and so on. But how do you... And so Prabhupada was able to impart this knowledge to us, and in that way he was showing us we have to actually think and have to ask questions. So blind following, which is truly blind, is not good. But in the sense of having faith and confidence that the instructions given to me by a spiritual master, they're right, they're correct. Well, that's what he meant, I think, when he said that I'm blindly following what my spiritual master said. He wasn't not questioning it, but he knew that he was doing the right thing. He had his good will in mind, that he wanted the right thing to be done. That he had in mind what it would be, the correct thing. That's the way I interpret it anyway. Yeah.
Stepping out of faith, for example. You don't quite know how it's going to work.
Right. You have faith, you have confidence, you have conviction that this person is telling me the right thing. So he has, my good in mind, what's going to develop. And he's like a father, he's going to help me. And then it unravels, and therefore that can be questioned. But in the sense that it's good and going to help, that's blind in the sense that confidence and conviction and sure, you know, confidence and all that sort of thing, yeah, faith is blind. Then we can apply it that way, I think. Any other comments? Questions there? Okay, so we'll end here. Thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.